Case for the day, Cyril George versus the Attorney General of the United States.
Good morning.
Good morning, Ms. Hebda. Hold on one moment while we get the thing settled here. Okay, Ms. Hebda.
May it please the court. My name is Kasia Hebda, and along with my colleagues at Troutman Sanders, I am pro bono counsel for petitioner Cyril George. We are here today because the BIA made three fundamental errors when it determined that Mr. George was removable based on a 1994 guilty plea for misdemeanor sexual misconduct. First, the BIA erred when it applied the categorical approach instead of the modified categorical approach instead of the categorical approach. Second, the BIA erred by relying on a witness statement as if it were a valid Shepherd document in this analysis. And finally, the BIA erred by concluding that statement provided clear and convincing evidence that Mr. George pleaded guilty to an aggravated felony and a crime involving moral turpitude. Any one of these errors is fatal and demands reversal of the BIA's decision.
So let's assume for the moment I agree with you on one, that they should have applied the categorical as opposed to the modified.
Yes.
And let's assume for the moment I agree with you on error number two, that we can't tell what it was under the document, so we pick the least culpable crime that could have been alleged under the statute, under New York Section 12030. I want to get to number three.
Okay.
Where have we ever said that categorically statutory rape between, I think it would be someone who's just almost 17, so 16 under the Florida, under the statute, and someone who has just turned 18, so that would be the least culpable.
Yes.
That statutory rape is not a crime of moral turpitude, crime involving moral turpitude.
In Esquivel-Quintana...
So Esquivel-Quintana goes to aggravated felony and deals with categorical test as to an aggravated felony. Our test... under Gelin, which is the most recent that I've seen, is different for a categorical approach for a moral turpitude crime. Is it not?
I'm not aware of there being a difference.
Well, they're defined differently, aren't they? So here's what we've said, that I, the best that I can tell, and I could be wrong on it. This is from Gelin, which is 837 F3rd 1236. Although the term moral turpitude is not defined by the statute, this court has held that it involves an act of baseness, vileness, or depravity in the private and social duties which a man owes to his fellow man and woman owes to a fellow woman, or to society in general, contrary to the accepted and customary rule of right and duty between man and man. That was from our Cano decision, and the BIA has adopted that. And then we, in the categorical approach, what we say is whether a felony in its least culpable form would conform to that test.
Yes, I understand exactly what you're saying.
And you agree that
that's... We cite this definition of a crime involving moral turpitude in our briefing. This court, and I don't think the Supreme Court, have specifically spoken to statutory rape. There's a Ninth Circuit case, I can give you the name.
I know it. I think it's Quinteros.
Yes.
Has said, but three other circuits have said exactly the opposite of that, and we haven't said one way or the other, right?
I don't think you have, no.
That really seems to be the issue to me in this case, because I agree with you, it can't be an aggravated felony, assuming with a categorical approach. And I tend to agree that we can't tell quite which, even if it's modified, which portion of the statute that it was charged here based on the Shepherd document that's in evidence here. So if this is a crime of moral turpitude, and putting aside the former section 212C issue, right, that could be problematic for you. You would agree?
Yes, yes. Okay. I agree that this could be problematic for me.
Okay.
I don't think that would be the correct decision to make. I think that even though Esquivel-Quintana looked at the question of whether when statutory rape is an aggravated felony and when it's not, I think that the same analysis applies. In that case, what they did is that they looked at the statutory rape laws in all of the states and looked at the age of consent in that law.
Let me fast forward a little bit. It's a great textual opinion, but what the court did there is then compared it to what it means to be an aggravated felony. In other words, the comparison on aggravated felony was essential to the holding in Esquivel, whereas here it's a completely different standard on what a moral turpitude crime is, right?
Well, yes. But it is a different standard, but I find it somewhat hard to believe that a consensual sexual relationship between someone who is 18 and someone who is almost 17, that relationship would be an act of baseness, vileness, or depravity in the private and social duties which a man owes his fellow man. That's a typical relationship between high schoolers.
Let's talk about that. So as you noted in Esquivel, they look at all the statutes there. Every single state has a statutory rape law, and more than half of them, that I can tell, have it from the point that New York does, from 17, the edge of 17 on. How then would, if it's a counting of the states, at least as a factor in what is base and vile, not look to those certain factors? And then my second question would be, even if there was some ambiguity here on this, why would we not defer to the BIA, who has said it is?
I think that even if something could potentially, even if half of the states, as you say, would...
Well, there's that great chart in Esquivel.
Right. There is the great chart. I don't recall exactly how many states,
right,
what the ages were, but I assume that you took a
look
at
that. It's close to half.
Yeah, it's close to half. I think there is a difference between saying that something is potentially statutory rape and saying that this charge is an act of baseness, vileness, or depravity. That seems to require a somewhat stricter standard than just this is potentially statutory rape in only half of the states. As to your second question as to why you would not need to defer to the BIA for this court reviews questions of law like this de novo, and I think this is a question of law that, well, number one, this court reviews questions of law like this de novo, but also the BIA in this case did not find that this statute was categorically a crime involving moral turpitude.
Did it not?
I mean, it did not. All it did was the BIA immediately, once it found that the statute was divisible.
Can I read from you from the order? Do you mind?
Go ahead.
In the light of the foregoing discussion, we also affirm the immigration judge's determination that respondent's conviction for sexual misconduct qualifies as a crime involving moral turpitude because rape by forcible compulsion involves baseness and depravity.
Right, but that's rape by forcible compulsion.
It is, absolutely.
Not, they're not talking about rape by incapacity due to age.
That's true.
And so they did not reach the conclusion that a conviction for sexual misconduct by incapacity to consent.
All right, let's say you're right about that. So that's interesting point. So the remedy then for us would be, because the BIA erred in using the modified categorical approach and making the determination that this was rape by forcible compulsion, where you, from the record, you can't tell what it was.
Yes.
And it rested its decision on that. We would not reach the issue about whether the alternative, because they did not reach it, argument that even if it was the other, the statutory rape, that is a crime of moral turpitude, we would vacate and remand, and that would be something that the BIA would have to determine in the first instance. Is that right?
I mean, you can vacate and remand. We would suggest that
if they haven't made that determination, which is, I understood what your argument
yes.
a moment ago was, it would have to go back to them, would it not, for them to make whatever determination they want to make. Isn't
yes.
that the way this
yes.
agency review
yes.
works?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. You've saved 7 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Robbins. Mr. Robbins.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Robbins. I'm here on behalf of William Barr, the Attorney General. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
There are two primary issues in the case. There's the issue of petitioner's removability and whether the board properly applied the modified categorical approach. And then there's the next issue of whether the agency properly pre-terminated petitioner's application for a waiver of that removability under former section 212C of the INA.
So I'll fast forward you like I fast forwarded your colleague.
Sure.
So let's assume for the moment that I think that it might be a divisible statute, but that the Shepherd documents here are inconclusive, and therefore we have to assume the least culpable of ways to do it. Let's also assume, well, then I'll ask you, did the order that I read from or any other part of the order decide the issue of whether this is a moral turpitude crime? Because we know it's not an aggravated felony.
No. I believe that petitioner's reading of the order is correct. They applied the modified categorical approach, divided the statute, determined that forcible compulsion was at issue with respect to this statute,
and found that that was a moral
alternative.
And found that that was a moral turpitude crime.
Yes.
Okay.
And it did not reach the issue of whether it was a categorical match to a CIMT.
Do you agree with Judge Bill Pryor that if that's the case, and we at least have some question in our mind whether it's statutory rape in any form is a moral turpitude crime, that we need to send this back to the BIA?
Assuming the premise of your question without conceding those,
yes.
Then yes, that would be the appropriate recourse.
What is your position on whether statutory rape, here it would be someone who is 16 years and 364 days with having a consensual sexual relationship with someone who is just turned 18?
Well, it's my understanding, Your Honor, that the government's position is, as you alluded to, on the side of the circuits that have held that does encompass the type of conduct that would be constitute a CIMT, and we disagree with the Ninth Circuit's decision in the case that goes the other way. That has been our position
okay.
on that issue.
I don't see, though, how we can tell from this record what he pleaded to.
Well, Your Honor, if you'll allow me an opportunity perhaps to persuade you on that point.
The record says two CTS. I take that to mean two counts.
Yes.
And then it states both forcible compulsion and the statutory rape. And I'm left to guess which one he pleaded to, right?
Well, Your Honor, one of the things that I would point out is that let me address a couple of the attacks on this document that petitioners made in turn to sort of help explain this. When they first attacked this document, they said it wasn't a valid Shepherd document. They said, we don't really know what this document is. And we pointed out that this is a New York felony complaint.
I view it. It's a valid document, okay?
Okay. Well, if that
is. Tell me how I sure. know which he pleaded to.
Sure. If you look at the document itself, you'll see in handwritten notation it says reduced 180.5. 180.5 is a provision of the New York criminal procedure that deals with what happens when you reduce a felony complaint down to a non-felony charge, or the charges in a felony complaint to a non-felony. That specific criminal procedure discusses what happens. And it's important to recognize why New York puts this sort of factual assertion in its charging instrument. It's because it's showing that the prosecutor is going to be able to meet the elements of the offense, because if the accusations in the document can't meet the elements, it's not going to be a valid charge.
I think,
document.
Though, Judge Bill Pryor's question is this, and it's my question too, which is how from this document, I know what the facts are, assuming they're true. How do from this document do I know which of the kinds of lack of consent that he pled guilty to, given that it's an element and you've said it's an element, in New York Statute Section 130.05? How do I know from this?
Well, you would know it from a combination of things. Because the actual factual assertion in the document sets forth that the petitioner in this case used a gun to force sex on the child, That's the element that the prosecutor is seeking to prove. And under the provision 1080...
Except that it also states that he had non-consensual sex with a 14-year-old.
Right.
Which would fall under a different, the incapacity section, not the forcible compulsion section.
That's true, but I would point your attention...
This is sexual misconduct under 130.20, isn't it?
Right, but 130.05 is the one that defines lack of consent.
All right.
Yes, but when the charge gets reduced, if you look at the provision that's specifically annotated in here, 180.5, which discusses the criminal procedure, what it says is that in order to convert this felony complaint into the appropriate document for pleading guilty, it says in the case of such conversion, any supporting deposition supporting or accompanying the felony complaint is deemed, quote, deemed also to support or accompany the information to which it has been converted. So when petitioner pled guilty to the converted document, he's waived any challenge that this factual support is not the basis for the...
I don't disagree, but there are certainly different kinds of elements here that he could have pled guilty to. One would be the underlying statute, 130.20, with lack of consent being incapacity. That is a very different thing than I'm pleading guilty to 130.20 with the lack of consent being forcible compulsion.
I take your point, Your Honor.
How do I know? And that's what Judge Bill Pryor is asking. How do we know from this document which of the two to which he pled guilty, especially if we agree with you, and I do, that it's an element, that it's a divisible element?
Well, Your Honor, this is all we have. All we can say is that the factual assertion that is outlined here specifically sets forth that there is there was force used, and there's really no reasonable way to read this other than that the petitioner used the force. I take Your Honor's point, but...
Well, there is a reasonable way to read that he only pled guilty to something a lot less minor than forcible compulsion, and we know that because he pled guilty to a misdemeanor and not the first-degree life felony to which he was charged.
Well, Your Honor, the only thing I would point to is that this document doesn't make any annotations to the factual assertions that are in here where it does with respect to the accusatory parts of the document. And so there's no indication to suggest the petitioner wasn't waiving any notion that the forcible part of the accusatory instrument wasn't also following through to the underlying.
And counsel, I don't blame you for this is the document you have in evidence. I understand that. No one's blaming you, but it's... I'm left in the same position that Judge Bill Pryor was discussing, which is it's just impossible. If I agree with you that lack of consent is an element and there are divisible ways in which to do it, I'd have to know what he pled guilty to know which one would apply.
Right.
Your Honor, I take your point. I don't have any other arguments other than what we've presented for you now on that point, other than to suggest that the criminal procedure means that this follows through. But other than that, I don't have anything more for you on that. Do Your Honors want me to discuss any of the other issues in the case? Because the termination of the waiver of removability wouldn't be applicable if you thought he wasn't removable. But then it would have to be sent back for the board to determine in the first instance whether this is a categorical CIMT. Because then only if he's removable under that basis would the termination of the waiver of removability kick in and that part of the analysis kick in.
Right.
Do Your Honors have any other further questions?
I don't.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Hepta, you want to take the win?
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to remind you that in this case, the government had the burden of proving that Mr. George was removable by clear and convincing evidence. Here, even they cannot look at this document and explain how it shows that he was convicted of an aggravated felony or a CIMT. And with that, I can conclude. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be in recess until tomorrow. Thank you very much.
All rise.